Well, hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Lisa Schmeiser, host and co-host of a variety of podcasts on the Incomparable Network. And Lisa has chosen for us to discuss Neuromancer, the cyberpunk classic winner of the 1985 Hugo Award for Best Novel by William Gibson. So Lisa, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for thinking of me, especially with this novel. It's one of my favorites.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to getting your thoughts on this, because as has happened on 3 out of 4 of these episodes that I've done, I'm a first-time reader. And so I like to get a more considered opinion from somebody who's read it a few more times. And so right off the top.
Do we want to just start with how we respect to what your origin story? Was it the stacks of a library? Was it a relative? Are these the kind of questions you want to find out how I came into the whole fantasy and sci-fi readership?
Yeah. I want to start there. I was getting ahead of myself.
Okay. So. Yeah. So let's start there. I didn't look this up on IMDb before popping on to talk with you. But when I was in kindergarten, there was a cartoon adaptation of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe that came out.
I remember that one.
And I watched it and was entranced. And my parents bought me this beautiful box set of the Chronicles of Narnia, like these great 1970s covers where the colors are all weirdly saturated and everybody looks really groovy. And I read through, and that was kind of my introduction to fantasy. And from there, it was just a hop, skip, and a jump to like Jane Yolen and a lot of her books, which were for younger readers. And at the same time, my dad and I had always made a habit of watching, you know, original Star Trek together. Star Wars hit about the same time The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe did, and I was head over heels about Star Wars. And so that brought the spacefaring and space princess and space opera element into it. And then when my dad used to go on submarine runs, and one of the guys that he went out with used to bring him these duffel bags full of Piers Anthony Xanth books.
Oh, nice.
Well, you know what? They're basically written for fourth graders. I mean, you take out the really salacious 13-year-old boy perspective, and right. You know, it makes an elementary schooler feel really intelligent if they can get the puns, or they can get the jokes, or they can get the cultural references. And in the back of the book, Piers Anthony always writes, "And I have this joke. Wasn't I clever? Tee hee hee." And he basically, he basically explains all the jokes. And when you're in fourth and fifth grade, to, you know, check that against the ones you picked up, it's kind of like, ooh, it's a secret key. And so by the time I got to middle school, I was pretty firmly entrenched in our library's sci-fi section. I fell into Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern, and I've talked about that on a podcast with Anthony Johnson, the Unjustly Maligned podcast.
Oh, interesting. I'll put a link in the show notes because I haven't listened to that one.
Because That series has gotten, it's been really interesting to watch the pushback develop over time with that series. And so I got into that. And when we moved for my dad's latest defense-related job, the library in our new hometown had a dedicated sci-fi and fantasy section.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was 15. And so from 15 to 18, I basically camped out there every weekend and, you know, obsessively read my way through everything I could find. And that was it. No, paradoxically, as I've gotten older and have had more free income, which I could, in theory, put towards more sci-fi books, I've had less time to read them. So the majority of my Nebula and Hugo, I've read that knowledge spans from like 1980 to about 1994. And then after that, there's a really sharp drop off a cliff. So,
oh, interesting.
It's embarrassing.
It's so, yeah. Kind of the opposite to my story, because I just was not a reader. When I was little, I think when I was in grade school, I read the Lloyd Alexander Prydain Chronicles.
Oh, yeah, I remember those.
And I loved those, but something happened. I think I became a middle school boy and decided that reading wasn't cool anymore. And just was not into it at all until basically college when I started reading again. So I have an enormous gap in especially my geeky reading, because I've only come to kind of science fiction and a little bit of fantasy just in the last probably 10 years.
Yeah. Well, with fantasy, it's really hit or miss with me, because now that I've read history, and then you get into these fantasy worlds, which are set in a culture that usually approximates about 14th century Europe.
Right.
You know, my brain keeps tripping over details. Like, why aren't the streets smelling like human waste? Or why hasn't a third of the peasantry died of the plague? So,
yes. Yeah, people are much more well-groomed in fantasy novels than you'd think they would be.
Oh yeah, no, and all the vassals are super happy to be toiling in the fields, and it's you know, there's it strains credulity. And I've also gotten much more finicky as I've gotten older too, and I think that hurts me as a reader sometimes.
Right. So, for anybody out there who's listening to this who doesn't already know who you are, and I'm assuming that almost everybody who's going to come and listen to this is coming over because they see your name on it, because I'm just starting out here. I'm kind of networking through my guests. But for those, you know, 7 or 8 listeners who have come over from my other podcast, why don't you tell them a bit about The Incomparable and kind of where you fit in there?
Sure. So The Incomparable was launched by Jason Snell, who is, I would actually say, he's one of the quiet masterminds behind the shift in media over the last 20 odd years. Like, he twigged to what the web was going to be about early on, and, you know, built out some interesting content projects there. And he's doing the same now for podcasting. And the approach to The Incomparable is it's generally geeky topics, and we talk about them, we delve into them, we critique them, but you always do so from a position of appreciation and enthusiasm. And even if you don't appreciate a specific thing, the idea is that you like what you like, and it's okay to like it. So,
right.
You know, here's an example. One of the podcasts I host is called the Flash Flashcast, where we talk about the CW Flash series every week. And we started it in part because the two guys I do it with, the three of us, love talking about TV shows together. We really got into The Flash. We're very enthusiastic about it. And over the course of season 3...
not so much.
Well, and this actually precipitated the last few episodes of The Flashcast, where we were like, we don't enjoy the show. And that's not in the ethos of either The Incomparable or The Flash Flashcast. So, you know, we're calling it a wrap. The great thing about The Incomparable is if you want to pick up the ball and run with something... all for it. Like, there's a podcast that's dedicated to a live action Dungeons and Dragons game.
Right.
There's one called The Villain Edit, which explores villains in pop culture. The other one that I co-host is called Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies.
Love that one.
And the premise is that we review a movie that has not come out in a theater yet, based solely on the trailer.
Right.
But it's also been a great opportunity for us to talk about movies we do like and filmic conventions or genres that really get us going and why. And, you know, so a lot of the podcasts do just explore, we love this and this is why we love it, or we consume this and these are our thoughts on it.
Yeah, I enjoy on Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies. I really do enjoy that you and Phil have differing perspectives. Like, you like the superhero films, where he does not. And, you know, he's the curator of the Old Movie Club, is he not?
Yeah. Philip Michaels co-hosts the Old Movie Club, where he picks 2 movies that are complementary or have similar themes in some way. Participants watch both movies and then assess them in kind of a compare and contrast kind of way, you know, and ask, were they successful individually and how do they fit into a larger body, thematically speaking?
Okay. So, more about you. I think you're a writer by trade. Is that correct?
I am, by the day job, I'm the editor of 2 tech-facing websites. One is called SuperSite for Windows, and we've broadened the scope out from just the Windows platform to take a look at mobile computing, productivity, cloud computing, things like that. And the other website that I edit actually has a paid subscriber newsletter. It's called Windows Secrets. I inherited the site from a predecessor, and that one is much more how-to oriented, and it takes a look simply how to work better using the Windows platform. So I pretty much cover Microsoft as my primary beat in the day job these days. And I also, I'm a freelance reporter and writer, and I'm also writing for The Observer right now. I do a twice weekly column there that you can get through an email newsletter called So What Who Cares?
Nice. So I did send you the outline kind of late. I don't know if you got the chance to brag about how many Hugo Warners you have read. Have you done the tally?
I did do the tally, and I have only read 44. So
44.
Oh, I should actually amend that. It's not just Hugo winners. I tallied up both nominees and winners, and the total is 44 out of the winners. 15.
I think we're tied.
Oh, wow. Very nice. But I don't have a podcast about it, so what's your excuse? I'm giving you a hard time.
I'm doing this in order to force myself to actually read these things that I've been wanting to read.
Good, good.
Yeah. Okay, so why don't we talk about the book a bit? Can you give me an elevator pitch for... Or like the flash recap for Neuromancer without spoilers.
So if I had to say, read Neuromancer and someone goes, oh, what is it about? I'd say it's basically a classic noir set in a profoundly globalized society. And you have a hard-boiled protagonist who has made a series of very bad decisions, who gets caught up in a conspiracy of circumstances that he can barely begin to comprehend. And he emerges from his misadventures a little bit better off than he started.
Nice. I think that's good.
Yeah, it's basically, it took me a while to see this. I should add, I read Neuromancer for the first time when I was in college. Yeah, when I was in college in the very early 1990s. And then the second time I actually had to read it for a class in grad school on the history of communications technology. Because we read your classic texts that talk about, you know, well, first is the oral transmission of communications, and then there's the written one. And this was 1995, and MUDs and virtual reality were all big. And the professor at the time was like, well, Neuromancer is clearly modeling where all of this is going to go. And so we had to read it and discuss it in class for like 2 weeks straight. And so that was the second time I read it, and it really sank its hooks into me then. And I've read it intermittently, I think, 2 or 3 more times since. And in preparation for the podcast, I did another reading, you know, just a fairly casual, and one of the things that I noticed about this time is I was like, you know, if you strip out the technology, it's got the bones of a Raymond Chandler story. So... you could always, so if you have a friend who's perhaps not really big into sci-fi because they're like, I don't like spaceships, or or they're like, I really hate worlds where people take all their food in pill form. You can say, well, this is not really it. What this is just imagine it's a Bloomberg terminal about 50 years out from now, and there's a noir story about it. And what I find interesting about this book now is seeing how prescient it has become regarding a lot of the tiny cultural details that are woven to give the book a distinctly sci-fi flavor.
Yeah. That's an interesting point, too. I mean, I was looking at it as like a heist movie in book form.
But that's another good way of putting it, too.
But the idea of it being a noir makes a lot of sense, too.
It reminds me a lot of the Maltese Falcon, in a way, where, you know, you've got a character who slides into a conspiracy that other people have woven and decided he'll be a patsy for you know, pushing. He'll be the mouse in the mousetrap that makes the ball roll and the basket drop and so on and so forth. There's a woman there who's a dupe, or rather hopes to dupe him. He's carrying heavy emotional baggage that they can exploit. And at the end of it, he's lucky to emerge with his life, and he's maybe not as poor as he used to be. And the one... thing that everybody else wanted, i.e. the Falcon, turns out not to be that big of a deal anyway. But you're right in the sense that it's a heist movie where, as it turns out, the object of the heist has actually orchestrated the whole heist.
Right. And that's the interesting thing about it. And that's a little bit spoilery, but it's pretty spoiler light. In this section, I want to stay fairly spoiler light.
Yeah.
You know, what I want to do with this part of it is entice people to read, you know, give them kind of our overall impressions.
So the reasons I'd give for reading it, I find the language interesting precisely because Gibson is one of the more interesting sci-fi writers in that he really thinks out the material aspects of his world from a consumer perspective. He always describes fabrics, like whether it's the fabric of the chair someone is sitting on, or the coverlet that their bleeding body has been laid upon, or the jacket that somebody is wearing. He uses fabric. It's a leitmotif in all of his work, where fabric is a signifier. There's a passage in the follow-up book to this, Count Zero. There's actually a passage that lovingly describes a French flannel shirt in gray, and he describes like the feel and the heft of it and the cut. And what you have to know about Gibson in real life is before he successfully sold writing, he actually used to trawl thrift shops and do a lot of clothing resales. And he's actually a serious clothing otaku. Like, he's big into denim, and he's become a major brand jeans head. So obviously clothing and fabric are really interesting to him. But there is such an overwhelming tactile sense in his books, everything from how things smell to what they feel like, to how the light catches, you know, a surface of something. The way he describes hardware, and especially the way he was describing it in the 80s, back when that weird medicine, that weird bandage beige plastic was all in vogue, and he was able to like successfully forecast down the line and say, no, people are going to make this decorative. It's a consumer good, not an office tool. Mm-hmm. And everything from sounds to tastes. So one of the things I really enjoy about the way he writes is how sensuous it is. And I don't mean that in a salacious way. I mean that in a way where it fully engages all of your senses. And what's more is it helps ground the work in whatever your own perceptions are as a consumer and somebody who lives in a world and has probably picked one t-shirt over another because you liked the way the fabric felt, or, mm-hmm. or who's recoiled from, you know, like you're in an airport, you're like, I can't sit on that chair. That chair looks like it's going to bite me. You know, you read him and you read somebody who's clearly thought about what the future is going to look and feel and smell and sound and taste like. And I find that tremendously appealing. Like, to me, that's much, much better than, you know, CyberX jockey came screaming in above a neon sky, slurped down a krill smoothie, and then, you know, swung a leg over his piston to blah, blah, blah. And you're like, that tells me nothing. Whereas, a typical Gibson passage might include the casual mention of somebody frying a krill patty, or, and this is not spoilery, there is a scene in Neuromancer where the protagonist is coming down off of an illicit drug high, and he's being served a steak at a nightclub, and he can't eat it, and his companion says irritably, they had to grow a whole animal just to kill it for that steak. Do you have any idea how much waste goes into that? And that was just such an elegant way of pointing out how resources are deployed in a luxury perspective versus for the masses, and how different those experiences are. It's just such a great example of show, don't tell. And it's rooted in something that goes back literally millions of years, people cooking and eating animals. So, mm-hmm. So I loved it for that. I love it because, again, most of his books are either capers or basically, you know, noir mysteries draped in the future. And I think one of the reasons I like that is because he's effectively used one form to very sneakily transmit ideas about what he thinks is happening, you know, right now in the present and in the future. And as somebody who does enjoy trying to read the tea leaves and see where we're going and whether or not we have any say in where we're going and how we get there, I find his books really useful as a primer to, here are the currents that other people have picked up and begun surfing on, or here are the eddies and the flows that are being ignored, and, you know, asking why.
Well, so I'm curious, the first time you read it, mm-hmm. you said you read it in middle school?
No, in college. I was in college in the early 90s.
Yeah, so was I. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
yeah, I graduated high school in 91, so.
Yeah, I could lie about my age if that makes us get more listeners. but yeah, it was one of just this. I had a couple friends in college who had very, very deep bookshelves with regard to sci-fi. And I went to an engineering school, so they were thick on the ground anyway. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those books where I just sat down on a couch over a weekend with a stack of like four or five books. And I remember reading that and reading David Brin's Earth and a couple others at the same time. And, you know, at school, we already had access to the internet, and this didn't seem like it was too much of a hop, skip, and a jump to where we were going. Mm-hmm. So when I read it just as, oh, it's entertaining, whatever, and tossed it aside, that was one thing. But it wasn't until the second time I had to read it, which was in graduate school in 95, where I had to pay attention to it. And that's when I really got sucked in. And I had to read it like two or three times for class, you know, and do a pretty close reading. And after that was done, I like went to the nearest Borders, because in those days, children, we had bookstores we went to, and and picked up everything else by William Gibson that night, and then just kind of obsessively read through the Sprawl trilogy over a couple of months, like repeatedly, you know, poking through. And like I said, this was about the time that cyberpunk fiction had been cresting anyway, so I also bought a couple of anthologies. I was reading my way through Neal Stephenson's back catalog, tried to get into Bruce Sterling and failed. You know, Rudy Rucker had just started coming out with the wetware stuff that he was doing, so I was reading that too. But I kept coming back to the Gibson stuff over and over because I was fascinated by his conceit of cyberspace. And I remember thinking, I don't see how this is going to work, because I don't see how people are going to voluntarily drop out of drop out of the ebb and flow of human life just to stay jacked into a virtual world.
Right.
And then like 10 years later when I was walking, no, like 10 years later when I was walking around San Francisco looking at people on their phones, I thought, oh my God, we've actually averted it. We've, instead of sucking people into cyberspace, what we've managed to do is blow the bubble out.
Right. Brought cyberspace out into everybody's hands.
Yeah. So we're not plugged in. We're not plugged in console jockeys with VR. What we've effectively done is we've given everybody the tools to create their own little bubble.
Mm-hmm.
So like the big cyberspace idea that Gibson puts forth in the book is cyberspace is this consensual hallucination.
Right.
You know, and I thought, well, that's really interesting that that definition has caught on. People used it for the World Wide Web, but with the mobile technology that everybody has in their pockets now and, the number of apps and the filter bubbles that have been put in place by search engines and preferences on websites and things like that, there is no consensual hallucination about it. We've all created our own little virtual worlds. And right. The interesting stuff that happens now in real life is these worlds bump up and bubble against each other, often without a whole lot of mediating context.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, I find it interesting that the central fundamental premise of cyberspace as understood by, say, consumers, is completely wrong.
Right. Sure.
But we wouldn't have gotten there without Gibson because, you know, you had generations that read this work and then went to work on the World Wide Web or went to work on websites or on apps and have all been kind of pushing towards the idea that online spaces are spaces that you can create a more perfect understanding of intelligence on. And these utopian visions always fail, but people still try them.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was going to ask you if it had good reread return on investment, but it sounds to me like you kind of already answered that. I did want to ask about the sequels because it's the Sprawl trilogy, right?
Yeah. Yes. It's the Sprawl trilogy that's followed by Count Zero and then Mona Lisa Overdrive. And without spoiling the books, the basic arc of the series or the interconnected capers comes down to the idea of how humanity learns to identify other types of intelligence and what they do when that intelligence makes contact with them.
Nice.
And this is all done within the context of people pulling capers, because book number two is basically about one incredibly wealthy biotech firm stealing a researcher from another. And so book number two is about corporate espionage. And book number three is about a soap opera star who is recovering from drug addiction. But all of them have their parts to play in this overarching scheme that an artificial intelligence has devised.
So, you know, I have to admit that I didn't really get this book on my first read through. And what I did was I read it and I listened to the audiobook. And so I've sort of read it twice.
Uh-huh.
The only problem was I started listening to the audiobook before I finished the book. So that made it a little muddled for me because I didn't really connect to the book. I didn't find that it really held my attention.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I had a couple of places where I kind of had to go back and go, wait, how did we get onto a space station?
Yeah. Because he lies. He just mentions a JAL shuttle and the next thing you know, they're up in the orbital and you're like, oh, that's what happened.
Right.
So I will say, and I say this as somebody who passionately loves a lot of William Gibson's work and you know, I love the Sprawl trilogy. I love the Bijan trilogy. I love the Different Light trilogy. I love them all. And I enjoy looking for Easter eggs that indicate there might be some connections and I could talk your ear off about the themes that are embroidered in all of them. But he's always been pretty weak on endings, to be frank. Because what he does is he introduces some really interesting ideas and there are insights that will grab into your brain and stay there for a while. And then he moves all the chess pieces into place. And you're like, I can't wait to see what happens. And then there's like a chapter. Usually there's somebody, usually a woman, who's a badass and things manage to explode. There may or may not be a motorcycle involved. Somebody is wearing some kind of Kevlar because he has a real fetish for protective gear and it comes out in every book. And then there is basically like three paragraphs where it's the equivalent of somebody hand waving and saying, oh, that's all done with. And now we're cleaning up. And you're like, wait, what? What? It happens in all of his books. It is a structural weakness. And I think Neuromancer is actually a very good example of that, where there's this huge buildup. And by the end of it, you've got a psychopath who also happens to be an artist who can throw hallucinations in front of other people, and you've got a woman who's been cybernetically augmented like three different ways, and you've got the drug addict who's a cyberspace jockey who's working with his dead friend, and you've got a ninja, you've got a crazy heiress who may or may not have been cloned from other crazy heiresses, and you've got a space station involved, and two competing AIs, and a really baroque clockwork head that needs both a key and a series of notes to make it work, and then you've also got space Rastafarians, and they all get thrown together, and they get thrown together in the final chapters, and you're like, oh, this is weird, because like the ninjas and the Rastafarians go out, and the heiress loses her mind, and blah blah blah, and then it's literally like five paragraphs, and all of a sudden he had a moment of clarity and understanding, and then it's like flash cut epilogue, and you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
And the first time that happened, like, I literally, I flipped back and read through, and I was like, did I miss something in previous chapters? And right. I thought, well, maybe the way I can answer it in this book is maybe the point is supposed to be that the protagonist, Case, with whom we're encouraged to empathize, maybe everything is so far over his flippant head that we're seeing what happens through his eyes. Like, we don't get the omniscient explanation for it because his little pea brain can't grasp it anyway.
I could buy that.
But yeah, it's a weakness of all of his books.
Okay.
Mona Lisa Overdrive has a strong ending to it, which is good. But I do have to say that this whole, and then things wrapped up. You're like, oh, really? Yeah. Is that how? So.
Yeah. So, now, one thing I did like, and maybe, and no, I don't have to get too much into spoilers about this, but I did like the kind of layers of manipulation that were going on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because he meets Armitage,
yeah,
who is the boss, and then kind of investigates him, and then finds out he's being manipulated by an AI. And so I really did enjoy that kind of switcheroo that was pulled there. Okay, who's really behind everything?
Then when you find out who has been manipulating his dead ex-girlfriend, and again, not a spoiler, she's dead early on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's that. Yeah. No, I was going to say in Pattern Recognition, Spook Country, and Zero History, like in all three of them, the endings tend to wobble a little bit. And I found the same thing in Idoru. There's a little bit of a wobble at the end, and certainly in Neuromancer. So it's a stylistic thing.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're okay with the rest of the book, you're like, well, all right, this is what happens. So
yeah, you know, I wasn't really turned off by the ending. I did find it a little abrupt, and I didn't quite do the flip back, you know, to be like, wait, was that it?
Yeah.
But I kind of reread the epilogue again to find out. Just to make sure I had that solid.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it's an Easter egg, but if you do a close reading of Mona Lisa Overdrive, there is literally one line about what's happened to Case, because Mona Lisa Overdrive takes place approximately 7 to 9 years after Neuromancer. And so Molly returns in that book, and she does have one throwaway line about Case. And you're like, really? That is what happened? Mm. And I think the reason I like that is because it's the idea that people can remake themselves within their circumstances, or can change their circumstances if they have means. I mean, one of the big themes in this book is that it's good to have money, and it's not in a very green is good kind of way. It just does a very good job of pointing out how many doors open for you when you do not have to watch your bottom line.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, and this actually comes at a later point in your podcast when we talk about this, but Gibson's Meditations on Capital and how people use it, that's another thing that recurs in almost all of his books.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get to talking about, you know, what's unique about this book in general, you know, I'll elaborate further on how I'm going to argue this is essentially the first novel of the 21st century.
Okay.
So.
Cool. Yeah. Sounds good. So before we get into spoilers, just by way of further enticing people, fans of what other works, you know, films, television, books might be interested in Neuromancer.
Let's see. If you like Philip, well, you know what? If you actually like the film Blade Runner, or if you liked the spate of like weird, slick movies, Strange Days, like if you liked the overall feel of that movie, or even Virtuosity, or let's put it this way, if you like the Peter Gabriel soundtrack from Virtuosity, you probably are on the aesthetic wavelength for this book. Okay. I'm going to make an argument that if you like Dashiell Hammett, you'd probably like this book. Right. And in another way, if you are the type of person where material culture, and by that I mean, you know, what people wear and what they live in and how they live, if that's something you highly value in fiction, like, give this a try. Gibson's language tends to be more literary than a lot of sci-fi types, and it also tends to be very heavily allusive, A-L-L-U-S-I-V-E, and very evocative. And so if you're somebody who enjoys sentence fragments that, you know, have entire lexicons of meaning encoded into them, then, you know, good news, here you go.
Yeah, I suspect that one of the things that kept me from connecting to the book enough was just I wasn't giving the book a chance. I was doing a million other things, and so I'd sit down and read not even a whole chapter, and that's not really giving the author a chance to pull me in, and it's not giving my brain time to settle into it either. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's spoiler time, like major spoilers. So hopefully by this time, listener, we have convinced you to either listen to the book or just, you know, to heck with it. I'll listen anyway to the spoilers. So one thing that I found interesting about this one is the last book that I did was Hyperion, which has this vast world building in it of this huge kind of galactic empire almost.
Yeah.
Where Neuromancer seems much more claustrophobic.
Uh-huh.
And that's probably just because of the whole nature of cyberspace and being jacked into something, you know, not being on the outside.
Yeah.
But it just felt like he didn't spend a whole lot of time laying out, and here is the exact geopolitical situation on Earth right now.
Yeah.
You never hear mention of the United States, and Japan seems to be larger.
So what I said a few minutes ago about, I think this is the first novel of the 21st century. When I read it this time, what I was really struck by was you're looking at a world in which globalization has effectively erased nearly every national boundary. Like, at this point, nations are more ideas or are more cultural signifiers than they are significant entities. Mm-hmm. And with the reference to, you know, the corporate interests that control things, or the gang interests, you're basically looking at a world where money flows, where there are no borders because money gets to go where money wants to go. And, descriptors like Swiss, French, Italian, Japanese, so on and so forth, like those tend to have a few like lifestyle type signifiers attached to them. But sure. But the conceit of nations as we understand them is gone. And I was thinking about this today when I was thinking about how we were going to talk about this book. And what I would argue is centuries are pretty arbitrary anyway. You know, like, cause whoever says, oh yes, wait, there, here's a story that arcs perfectly over 100 years and here's the beginning and here's the end of it. And, like, that's not how it works. And I thought, well, you know, arguably speaking, the 20th century probably started with World War I, and it probably ended with World War II because immediately after World War II, you had all of these political arrangements where aid was being sent from one country to another. Yeah. The idea of borders was shown to be patently ridiculous when it came to Berlin. Cause I mean, look at how weird and unsustainable and unnatural that situation was for 40 years, right?
Yeah.
And then you had the rise of a lot of multinational trading bodies and human rights bodies and supervisory bodies because the UN finally got traction going. And so you had a cultural move towards globalization, and you had a civic move towards globalization in the sense that aid flowed from countries that could give it to countries that needed it and back again. You had a rise of cultural exchange programs. And then starting in the 70s and arcing up to where we are now, you've had the movement of a lot of jobs across a lot of borders. At the same time, you've had a lot of products moving across different borders, and you've had money flowing all over the place, just washing into some countries, washing out. And then with the rise of cloud computing, which is something, because some countries have stricter privacy laws than others, you've had entire cloud services that are built up, you know, on the notion that we will host our data in these countries because your data is secure and protected here. And there's other countries that are now coming to play for the so-called edge computing, i.e. quote unquote, the edge of the cloud, which extends your ability for being able to access data and get it quickly and manipulate it quickly. And a lot of edge computing's appeal is, well, we're kind of in a different situation.
Yeah.
So what I thought was interesting about Neuromancer when I was reading it this time through was the cultural potlatch with the different, you know, like one character wears French fatigues. They talk about, you know, Finnish airspace at one point and the type of black ops that take place moving up against Russia. Japan is obviously like Chiba City, and Japan is obviously this relentlessly churning techno pop culture as well as a nexus for crime. You've got the Bama sprawl, which is from Boston to Atlanta. It's just become one long contiguous development. And I thought, well, yeah, this is the first novel I can think of that takes globalization and extrapolates it out to an end result, which is people who feel stateless. Like they may have an identification number for the sprawl, like Case does, but they're effectively people who float to where the jobs and the opportunity and the money are. And emigration is something that they don't do necessarily for political or ideological reasons. It's opportunist reasons. They're following the opportunities. They're following the goods. They're following the skills.
Yeah.
And so that's something I actually find kind of exciting about this book right now. At the same time, I also find it hideously depressing because, like you point out, there is no governing body or even a not-for-profit that watches out for people's human interests or watches out for people who can't take care of themselves. Like, this entire book is kind of an exercise in Darwinism.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one mention of a child in this book, they also mentioned the child was promptly killed by an AI. So yeah, after hiding that is that is horrifying. People's bodily integrity is routinely violated for profit and for gain. And it's kind of an interesting meditation in how the breakdown in city states that will protect their citizens' interest also leads to a breakdown in human dignity in a lot of ways, too. I don't think that's the book Gibson meant to write, but that's a message that seems to come out pretty loud and clear in it.
Yeah.
So there's that. That's, I mean, there's like cool stuff in there, but like some of the bigger ideas are definitely a little bit disturbing. And among those ideas is the notion that nations are basically going to be a collection of lifestyle choices. Like Scandinavian could be a shorthand for like really attractive blonde furniture and great black boots and a weird belief in subsidized childcare.
So kind of going back to what I was talking about earlier about the layers of manipulation that were going on, I also really liked. One thing that stuck out to me was the rapidly shifting perspectives that you got when Case was jacked in and he was connected to Molly's SimStim. And so he could switch from seeing what she was seeing and experiencing what she was experiencing and then back in, and then he's talking to the flatline. And it was, I don't think I ever found that that confusing, actually. That was something that I felt like was really, really well executed.
Yeah. I do too. And the what's comes through in some of the short stories he's written and gets elaborated on in books number 2 and 3 of the trilogy, as a matter of fact, is the idea that being able to ride someone else's senses and experience what they're experiencing turns into a consumer good. Right. And that gets commodified. And you're right. I think that's one of the strengths of the book. And then one of the themes behind it too is, even though Case can see what Molly is seeing and he gets her perspective and he can feel her pain when she's injured, he never learns the color of her eyes, for example. And I think the whole thing is supposed to be, well, you can know somebody physically in multiple ways because they're lovers, in addition to her being the armed muscle to keep him safe.
Right.
And so he can literally be in her senses and he can be in her body, but he never learns much about who she actually is. And I like that part of it too.
Yeah, Molly is a very strong character that I really, really enjoyed. And I get the impression she makes appearances in the other series and other properties. Or I think there's still Gibson, obviously.
But. Yeah, so she shows up in the Johnny Mnemonic short story.
Okay.
And I don't know if you'll remember this from the book, but she talks later about what happens after the story. You know, she talks to Case about that. I had a boy named Johnny. This is what the Yakuza are like. And the first time I finally connected that and was like, holy cats, that's what he did.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't made that connection.
Yeah. So I was like, oh my God, that's bold. But yeah, Molly shows up. She's one of the primary protagonists in Johnny Mnemonic. And then she also pops up again as hired muscle in Mona Lisa Overdrive.
Okay. So, I'm going to have to present Johnny Mnemonic as a topic on Take Me to Your Reader, my other one where we... where we talk about adapted science fiction, though I remember despising the film.
So. Yeah, I've never seen the film. I feel like cyberspace is tricky to adapt anyway.
Yeah.
For a lot of reasons. Because again, it's such a personal thing, and movies, by their nature, what they're encouraging you to do is to step into a more or less universal narrative, or rather buy into a consensual narrative.
Right. Yeah. Funny.
So yeah, it's funny how the consensual hallucination does not lend itself to the movies.
Right.
But yeah, I also find it I have really mixed feelings about Malcolm and Errol and the rest of the Rastafarians, because on the one hand, I do appreciate that the world is not completely white or Asian.
Right.
But on the other hand, I'm like, are you really the best guy to extrapolate how some black subcultures are going to work out in outer space? So there's a little bit of that. It is interesting to see that that religion does survive, and I did like the origin story, which is that basically five black guys from Los Angeles were hired to build the space station, and they refused to come down. And they were like, no, we're stoned Rastafarians in space now, and this is what we do.
Yeah. That was one of the one of my difficulties with the book was trying to capture the Jamaican patois in written form, and that's always difficult. I mean, even if you go over to Mark Twain, you know, and you look at the Southern twang or, you know, the way Huck Finn talks or the way Jem talks.
Yeah. It's always tricky. I feel like authors are always taking a risk with something like that too. There's an author I enjoy named Nancy Kress, who I believe also, she's been nominated for, the Hugos and the Nebulas. I don't think she may have won for novella. For Beggars in Spain. Hmm. Yeah. She's been nominated for Beggars in Spain and the sequel Beggars and Choosers. And there's a third book in the trilogy that I can't remember off the top of my head. But by that one, people are speaking a different patois. And there's an entirely different sentence construction. There's a lot of self-referential pronouns. And it's really off-putting at first. And you have to work hard to get into it. And I can appreciate that in this book, the Rastafarians were really supposed to be throwing Case off his game because he had literally never run into anything like that before. But part of me is like, this is a book that was written in the late 70s and early 80s. You know, exactly what sort of perspective are you coming from, you know, when you're taking a look at race relations and stereotypes here? It's a little uncomfortable to read it now in 2017. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I kind of feel that way a little bit about Molly, too. In the annals of sci-fi characters, especially sci-fi characters from the 80s, she's amazing. Because, you know, she's a woman who answers to basically herself, and she's not maternal, and she's not there to save anybody. Like, when she takes care of Case, it's because she's like, well, it is easier to have you functioning than it is to have you not functioning.
Right.
But at the same time, there's this really aggressive fetishization of her, where, oh my God, she wears leather pants and has raisins under her fingernails that she got by being a prostitute, and she's tough and she's sexual, and wow, and will any man ever own her? And you're just like, really? This is... Sure. You know, it's very much, you know, the phrase, the male gaze, like she's basically defined in the male gaze. And it's something that Gibson has gotten much better about as he's become a more mature writer, especially in his later works. And especially with female protagonists, he's not doing the dumb thing a lot of male writers do where the woman spends a lot of time admiring her own rack in the mirror. But, you know, his early stuff, you're just like, work on that male gaze a little, Bill.
I did enjoy, though, that that she was kind of she became the inciting incident for much of what happened in the latter portion of the book, because she was the one who said, look, we need to find out what Armitage's deal is.
Yeah. Why is he so weird? From. Yeah. Who's pulling the levers? Because her line at first was, I just get paid to do this, this, and this. Then after a while, she's like, something about this doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
So let's figure out what's... And she's brave because instead of ignoring the, something doesn't feel right, she faces it head on. So, I mean, there's some stuff in that book that definitely feels like way 80s, like the fetishization of ninjas in Japanese culture has a very 'cause like, you know, you and I are the same age. Can you remember the rising tide of movies in the 80s about how the Japanese were going to take over the American economy and put us all out of work? And like, there's a little flavor of that in here, but I think Gibson actually managed to hit a more fundamental truth, which is that there are different flavors of future being invented in non-Western cultures, and ideas cross borders and take on lives of their own in other cultures easily.
Yeah. I remember a time before, you know, every movie had amazing martial arts in it, where I would go to the video store. You remember the video store?
Oh, yeah.
and look for movies purely on how much ninja content they had in them. because it's like, I just wanted to watch ninja movies. That's who I was at the time. And yeah. I believe I actually had a shuriken, so.
A lot of people in the 80s did. Or the nunchaku. That was another big one, too. One of the most fascinating things about being a transplant from the East Coast to California, and I've been here for 2 decades, but I think it'll be a little while longer before I can finally say I've lived on the West Coast longer than the East Coast. But to me, one of the more fascinating things about moving out here was seeing how porous the boundaries are. For a lot of native Californians, I know burritos are comfort food, you know, like, and we're talking like Mexican style burritos, or like sushi is just what you have. Kanji is what you have when you're sick. Sushi is what you have for school lunch, of course. And it's not, you know, and not in the eye rolly John Hughes, you're bringing sushi to lunch, Claire, kind of way.
Right.
So there's already that porousness, you know, where cultures have basically picked up and adapted from each other. And, you know, you look at food trucks now where there's all sorts of fusion stuff. And I like that this book, I think this book forecasted. I read a afterword to this book where someone's like, oh, William Gibson predicted the future, and the people who read the book loved it and made that future come true. And I'm like, No, not really. I think he was lucky to live in a place that was actually a jumping off point for the Pacific Rim. So he got to see money and people flowing back and forth. And a lot of themes that he's come back to in many of his novels are evident here. Like I said, he has a fascination with how money makes people's lives easier, or how money gets things done. He has a fascination for seeing how people's lives are changed because they're using capital to get what they want. He also has a real fascination with the development of subcultures and the specific cultural and the specific social rituals they have, the clothes that they wear, the food that they eat, the accepted responses in different social situations. Like that comes up in this book. There's actually, let me see, I have it highlighted. I'm going to see if I can pull it up on my Kindle. He talks about the necessity of outlaw zones as a place to inculcate new businesses and new cultures. And that's something that actually comes up in several of his books, where the idea that well-heeled people and canny businessmen will send scouts into outlaw zones and subcultures to pick out the most commercially viable ideas that then get turned into pop culture or mass entertainment or mass consumption models. So, you know, that's there for him. He's always got a fascination with the idea that perhaps people who are religious are onto something, but he's not quite sure what. Here we go. Here's the quote. I wanted to, fad swept the youth of the sprawl at the speed of light. Entire subcultures could rise overnight. And, you know, he's fascinated by what makes a subculture catch on and catch fire. How people recognize good ideas, jump on them, and propagate them. He's really interested in the replication of information. How it becomes part of an accepted cultural narrative, and that starts in this book, and that gets repeated over and over again. And he is always, always, always interested in the idea that I wouldn't call them little people, but that ordinary people can get caught up as cogs in something bigger than themselves, and if they're lucky, they get out again.
Right.
Yeah. It's interesting to me because I went back and looked at this. This is his first full-length novel. And I went back and looked at this and I was like, wow, he basically wrote his own template for the themes he was going to explore for the next 30 years, which is kind of remarkable when you think about it. And his work over time has become less fascinated with how capital moves. And there's a little bit more moral judgment in it now. Both the winners and the losers, you know, he judges pretty harshly people who can make a difference and choose not to. His fascination with material culture and consumable goods as a reflection of values or lack thereof. Like, that's come through too. But yeah, a lot of his work is about what happens when you lose any sort of protective entity that's going to look out for the interests of people who can't look out for themselves. I mean, there's like a police force in here, like the AI Turing police force, but even right. They are not so much interested in protecting the rights of anybody. They're more interested in making sure that we don't build computer overlords that will rule us all, you know?
Right. And that's maybe a good, that's probably a good segue into talking about some of the themes. And mm-hmm. one of them that jumped out to me was that whole fear of artificial intelligence and the idea that, yeah, AIs are useful as long as they're in read-only memory.
Yeah.
But if they can improve themselves in any way, we have to destroy them.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that was just it was a fascinating idea to me. And I have a hard time believing that we would really have that much foresight.
Yeah. Well, yeah. What I find interesting about that, too, is there's this conversation that takes place between Case and Wintermute. And Wintermute is trying very patiently to explain to Case, using several different metaphors, that there is a big difference between having memory and knowing how to think.
True.
And he points out, listen, you know, I'm a computer. I can remember anything, but being able to think and pull together associations and then make inductive leaps, that's what I'm working for. And, right. You know, I think, again, as a tech reporter over the last 2 years, one of the emerging themes that's come up, especially at the conferences I go to, is they call it machine learning. The idea that you can teach machines to teach themselves and they'll improve and so on and so forth. And I keep thinking the reason it's going to be a technological dead end, the same way that VR was in the 90s, the reason it's going to be a technological dead end is because we still don't know how we think.
Right, right. I'm actually in that business.
So, here, as I'm blithely predicting your number. No, but we don't know how people think. What we can do is we can come up with models for cognition that you can teach. But you are going to be limited both by human imagination. You're going to be limited by the model itself. Mm-hmm. And so you can create a faster model, but fundamentally you're limited by the model and then you're limited by the data set. The same way that people are actually limited by the data that they do or don't get. You know, it's the ability to think contextually and adaptively that would make AIs really dangerous.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is you pick that up using data I'm not sure we can find a way to put into a computer system.
Right.
That said, I mean, we will get there eventually, but sure. You know, I mean, I'm not sure short-sighted is necessarily the right way, but I think maybe human beings have not fully imagined what they need to reckon with if they're going to bring in an intelligence that ravels their own.
Yeah. So kind of the other side of the AIs themselves was the idea of the flatline, right?
Yeah.
Where it's somebody's personality that has been kind of brought into cyberspace.
Yeah.
And then what kind of agency does that mm-hmm. being have? And is it really a being, you know? And I do feel like, while I wasn't completely thrilled with all of the book, I felt like the Dixie Flatline character was really compelling to me.
Yeah, so. Especially since he's like, I just want to die.
Yeah, I want to be erased.
Yeah, I want to be erased. Yeah, and I thought that was interesting where I was like, oh, he realizes the only self-determination he has left is whether or not he can live or die, and he wants to die. I also rather cynically thought, well, this is a great way to have a sidekick, a disposable sidekick. It's a great literary convention because you've got a sidekick, you can become attached to them, they've got personality, and they're not going to have a long-lasting relationship with the protagonist.
Right, yeah.
So
it was Jarvis from Iron Man,
right? Oh, yeah, exactly. And, you know, Jarvis is, of course, the flip side of Ultron.
Right.
No, and what I found also very interesting was that it is absolutely unsurprising to me that, of course, you'd have like two bat-crap crazy families that are like, I'm going to build an orbiting satellite and turn it into essentially Las Vegas in low gravity. And of course, I will create an army of clone children, thaw them out, do terrible things to them occasionally, and live forever. And I was like, yeah, that sounds about right. You know, that the type of people who had built that sort of thing would always be just bananas.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. But yeah, no, this book is, I feel like this book is about a stateless world, as it were. Like it's a post-globalization, it's a post-globalization world. And the real miracle is by the end of it, to me, the passage that sums it all up is there are several points in the book when Wintermute tells Case, you have to hate something. You're going to hate something before this is over. You're going to hate. Right. And eventually he points out, who do I hate? He asks. And then Wintermute actually says, well, who do you love? And that's when the book turns and Case. And I feel like that's the point where you're supposed to be like, oh, Case is finally, out of his death wish. Mm-hmm. And it's totally cool of him that this AI that killed his girlfriend now has a copy of the girlfriend's memories uploaded to the AI itself. And
right. Well, and there's a hint that Case himself is uploaded in some fashion.
Yeah.
Backing up to something that I was hoping with your more considered opinion about the book, the first place where I found that I was confused by the book was when they went to get Riviera. And as far as I could tell, they killed him.
Yes.
And then something sprung up out of his body and
no, Riviera has the ability to make people think they're hallucinating.
Okay. So that actually didn't happen.
No, that didn't happen. Riviera wanted them to think it did because he wanted to disorient them and gross them out and put them off their feed. And so when they go to get Riviera and he conjures the nightmare thing that jumps out of his spine and implies that he's dead, that's all a hallucination.
Okay. Wow. I never made that connection. Thank you.
Yeah. So yeah, because that's what makes him so dangerous is precisely because he really lives to mess with other people's perceptions and try to throw them off balance. He's got that really unhealthy obsession with Molly, and he's got this psychosexual kink that's tied to betrayal. And the one area I feel like this is really clever of Gibson, because you find out he's been working with 3 Jane, and so for a moment as a reader you're like, oh, he's going to betray her, and then you find no, he's not, and in fact she betrays him. So. Right. But that's kind of the classic noir thing where you've got like the beautiful and slightly unhinged daughter of the rich guy. Mm-hmm. And she, of course, has a completely unsuitable boyfriend, and the boyfriend is making trouble, and our hero has to deal with both of the weirdos. So it reminds me a little bit of some, it's not Chandler-esque because Chandler is funnier, and Gibson is funny in a very dry way, especially as he's gotten older, he's gotten funnier. But the people in his world are usually so desperate, or rather the stories he's telling about them are at times when they're at their most desperate that, colorful supporting characters can afford to be funny, but like usually you don't get a lot of stock comedy in his books. And here, 3 Jane and Riviera are certainly not fun.
Yeah.
We also live in a world where, or rather this book takes place in a world where hopping up to Straylight, which is the orbital Las Vegas, for lack of a better word. Like, apparently, like, going up into near space is no big deal anymore. You can get there using a JAL airliner of some sort.
Yeah, exactly.
And they have that really lovely passage about how Case is profoundly disoriented because, you know, monkey biology is not really set up for outer space. Then, of course, he manages with unerring accuracy to find the satellite's drug dealers. So.
Right. Yep. To find something that can get past his new pancreas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What I find interesting is once he gets his payoff, he like replaces his liver and his pancreas again.
Right. So he can go back to tweaking.
Yeah. And then apparently he stops. Also, here's one thing that I can't believe didn't make more of an impression on my brain is like in the first few chapters of the book, they mention how as a sign of how desperate he's become, they mention casually he's killed 3 people for scores he wouldn't have thought of looking at a year ago.
Right.
And that raises 2 simultaneous questions, which are 1, were those the first times he's had to kill? Or 2, had he killed in the past? And now he's like, I can't believe I've killed for sums this small, as opposed to I can't believe I've killed at all. Like, that's a nice bit of unnerving ambiguity. Because in the opening passages of the book, you're basically asked to identify with a drug-addled murderer. And he is your good guy.
Yeah. Right. So any other kind of themes or anything else you want to talk about or anything unique about the book that you want to talk about?
No, like I said, I think one of the biggest reasons to read it is it's uncanny how he's forecast what the 21st century is shaping up to be, which is a century where the notions of statehood and state protection are eroding in the face of global commerce and global culture. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's where that certainly seems to be where we're also headed right now, economically speaking and culturally speaking. I mean, you take a look at how fast fads slosh through social media these days, like where they originate and how they come out, and especially among people who have grown up as internet natives. I mean, you and I are of an age where we did not grow up that way. And so for us, it's like, oh, check out K-pop. But like, I have teenage nieces and nephews, and for them, K-pop is what they prefer to listen to. Boom, end of story. And it's just part of a bigger, it's just part of a bigger pop culture context where they think nothing of rooting for, you know, Brazilian women's soccer teams and listening to K-pop. And, and for them, countries are like a collection of, again, like it's a collection of attributes as opposed to a notion of geographic boundaries and a specific culture that includes some and excludes others, and a specific set of rules and socially accepted conventions and things like that. Like that notion of nationhood is really not something that they're into. And I feel like that book, I feel like this book perfectly captures that state. So it's a pretty compelling read in this day and age for that reason.
It's funny. When we were up in BC, I actually commented to my wife, I'm like, why is this Canada and that the US, you know, why does this happen?
Right. Yeah. Especially since Alaska's right up above it too. You're like, this makes no sense.
Yeah. And that's where I'm from actually.
Oh, Alaska?
Yep. From Anchorage.
Oh, right on. Oh, really? Yeah. I had a girlfriend. I have a girlfriend whose parents were, school teachers, and they got sent to a lot of little remote outposts. She was telling me her family did not have their own house or their own furniture until she was in college, because they just kept getting sent to remote towns where they, you know, had housing ready for the teachers.
Wow.
Already. So she grew up in a series of remote towns in Alaska. And what she told me, the story that stuck with me, and this almost feels sci-fi, and I wonder if something like this will come up in another Nebula book, is there was one time where she and her brother were playing near a lake. She lost her glasses in the lake, and her parents calculated the cost of taking the airplanes to get her new glasses versus hiring a local scuba diver to find the glasses. And it was actually cheaper to hire a diver to come in and find them than it was for her to get new glasses.
That's the economics of the bush.
Yeah, exactly. It was such a vivid illustration of how money matters differently in places where you're geographically isolated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she probably had a more authentic Alaska existence than I did, because I was a city kid.
Yeah, but you're a city kid where, like, the bald eagles all hang around the dumpsters from what I've seen with the pictures.
I mean, there are parts of Anchorage where, I mean, you get over to the edges of the city and, you know, black bears come into people's backyards and there's always moose.
Oh, wow.
So, and you know, you can drive for 20 minutes and be way out of town. So.
Yeah.
I found it weird here, actually, kind of talking about the sprawl. When I moved to, we're in Western Oregon, so just outside Portland. Uh-huh. And you can drive from where we are in Hillsboro into Beaverton and into Portland and up to Vancouver and into Washington, and you've never left the city. And that was very strange to me, because when you left Anchorage, you left the city. And then it was, you know, some period of time before you arrived at another.
Yeah. Now, every time I fly into Los Angeles at night, and I don't know if you've ever had the experience of flying to Los Angeles.
No, I don't think I have, actually.
No, if you ever fly in at night and you see, like, how far out it sprawls, I always think of it, always seems very Gibsonian to me that way. Because it's just this endless plane of sodium lights, and it goes on for, like, what feels like forever. And you're looking for anything resembling a landmark or some sign that there's actually natural topography under there. And it's really weird. But,
Yeah, I kind of had that experience when I was a kid, when we flew into Chicago.
Oh, yeah, it's another one.
And that was a big one.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you fly into Anchorage, and it's a large city, you know, several hundred thousand people live there.
Yeah.
But when you fly into it, you come in from the edge.
Yeah.
You know, you're flying in over the water, and you kind of have to look off to the side to see the city parts.
Yeah. So. Whereas when you fly into Chicago, it just keeps going. Well, the other thing that was weird, and this actually brings us back to Gibson and the theme of complete disconnect from the natural world, which I think is another theme that bubbles up a lot in this book, especially when they make references to vat-grown flesh and how people adulterate their bodies. Right. And this is, again, a guy, like, he starts the book with the sky was the color of dead television screens. And I know wags like to point out it's different now because they're blue and overtaken by technology and all that. But one of the things I find really interesting about that is completely cut off from the stars. And the first time we went to visit relatives in Chicago, and I looked up and the sky was like orange at night because of all of the light and all the light bouncing off of the lake. I remember thinking how weird and unnatural that was. But It's nice to have that point of reference when you're reading something like Neuromancer, where the environment has been so heavily adulterated that it doesn't even register with people anymore. So, yeah. I mean, the books are kind of trippy. I used to joke that if you really wanted to mess with your mind, you should read them while you've got a cold and you're whacked out on cold medicine, because that will just increase the feeling of emotive dislocation.
Sure.
But, you know, I do think they're worth reading for the way that he builds out worlds very casually and very evocatively without doing a lot of excessive verbiage. I mean, they're pretty lean. It's pretty lean in economical prose. Like, I've read people who are like, it's overheated. And from time to time, he gets really excited about jackets. But
But it's, I mean, it's not a slog. From, you know, it's not an 800-page book. You know, it's not, well, I've often said that, that was a 300-page book crammed into 800 pages.
Yeah.
Where the prose is just way too purple. And like, just get to the point.
Yeah.
And it's definitely not that. So for me, I think, I don't know, kind of moving towards final thoughts. Mm-hmm. One of the great things about reading something classic, and it kind of the double-edged sword of it, is anything really, really classic that has been super influential almost feels derivative of everything you've already seen.
Yeah, because it's the first, and people, people refined and expanded on the idea. And it's such a foundational part of so many things now that when you finally get back to the source material, you're like, really?
But there's also that, that's where that comes from.
Yeah.
Okay, The Matrix. Yes, The Matrix.
I know. When he mentioned that the first time, I'm like, oh my God, I was very excited about that. Yeah. Because The Matrix was another one that has that whole, it's a consensual hallucination thing. And even in 1999, it's a beautiful movie. And I've made the argument probably after a few margaritas, emphatically at restaurants after a few margaritas, that movie was the last time we really introduced a new language to filmic vocabulary, because they really found new ways to visually tell stories in there, especially with the special effects. And there hasn't been anything that's quite rocked us the same way. Maybe it only comes along every few decades. I don't know. But that was another one where I was like, you've managed to get cyberspace wrong, because people will not drop. It's not practical to, ignore your kids and plug into a cyberspace jack for 2 hours at a time. But it's crazy practical to take your kids to the playground and while they're running around on the swings and the swings set, you casually pull open your phone and dip back into Twitter or like however you prefer to build out your own little version of cyberspace, which is what people do.
I've been interested to see some of the ideas for the uses of cyberspace, like in Ready Player One, where essentially there's this place that people can go to school, by essentially jacking in and being present, but not really present.
Yeah.
So before we sign off, I do like to take a look at the competition for the Hugo in the year. And none of the other titles, I'm actually looking at them, none of them really stick out to me as anything that I'm aware of. I think Emergence by David R. Palmer, I think I actually have that one on my shelf. My dad gave it to me.
So I love Werner Vinge, but The Peace War is not what I'm... Hilariously enough, Werner Vinge has his own ideas about cyberspace, as it were, and he gets them with Fire on the Deep and a few other things later on. But in the same year, John Varley's novella Press Enter won the Hugo. And what's kind of hilarious about that is it's the other side of the coin to Neuromancer, because Press Enter is about what happens when an AI doesn't want to be discovered.
Oh, nice.
And what it can do to people who it decides it doesn't like. And I really love John Varley. He's a hoot. In the 70s, so there was a really unfortunate trend in the 70s where a lot of sci-fi writers were like, let's blow up all the taboos. And are parts of John Varley's work that are really weird, like when he sexualizes 13-year-olds, where you're like, that does not age. Or you're like, that was actually a problem in fandom at cons in the 60s and 70s too, where people are like, boundaries are so arbitrary. And you're like, no, they're kind of, some of them are kind of in place for a reason. But Varley does a lot. Varley had a really interesting conceit about space aliens deciding that planet Earth was in danger from humans because all the other species were being driven towards extinction. So it managed to engineer a way to get the humans off the planet, kill most of them, a handful escape, and managed to settle in the moon and the planets, and then cultures arose. And he's returned to that universe again and again. And those are fun to read. once he got out of the 70s and 80s, he got out of the regrettable tendency to, oh, people are so weird when they judge me as a 13-year-old for having sex. And you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Like, once he got older and got that out of his system, they smooth out and they're fun to read. So Varley as a writer can be wildly entertaining. And he's also another one who tries to extrapolate where things are going with middling success. And Press Enter is definitely worth reading.
Cool.
I remember reading it in the 80s and being like, whoa. And running across it again later. And best novelette that year is Bloodchild by Octavia Butler. And that one is a definite A++. Encourage people to read all day, every day, because it's a look at colonialism, except the people are the colonists who are the resources being exploited by aliens.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And it's sort of lays down some of the themes that she ends up exploring in some of her later work too. And I feel like it's a really accessible entry point for Octavia Butler.
Nice.
But yeah, what was funny was 1985 was a good year. 1987, however, had a lot of really great stuff. So when you feel like tackling 1987, you let me know.
What was 1987?
I am going to pull it up now. Orson Scott Card's Speaker for the Dead, Count Zero by William Gibson, The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, This is the Way the World Ends by James K. Morrow. All of them are heavy hitters. So
yeah. Actually, the next episode I'm going to record with Mandy Self, and we're going to talk about Speaker for the Dead.
Oh, so, very nice. I look forward to that one too.
That's one of my favorites. So that is one I've actually read a bazillion times.
Yeah.
So.
It's a complicated book. I didn't get into it the first time I read it. I had to go back and give it a reread because I had a nagging feeling I was missing something, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah. It was one that I checked out on audio first, and it was good that I did that because I didn't think I wanted to read it. But then about halfway through the book, I'm like, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Lisa, final thoughts or anything else you want to say about Neuromancer?
It's worth a read. There was an article in Slate recently talking about the literary challenges of sci-fi and you know, what happens when literary novelists pick up sci-fi conventions. They use Station Eleven from a couple of years ago as their jumping off point. But I feel like Neuromancer is one of those books that would actually end up in this category if it was being written today, because it's less overtly sci-fi in space. Like, you know, the space stuff is so subtle, it just kind of weaves its way in there. Again, it's worth reading because I really do believe it's the first novel of the 21st century. I think Gibson is the one who correctly identified when the 20th century ended and the 21st century began, wrote the first book about it. And it's a great way to get into basically everything else he's read, because almost every theme he's embroidered in subsequent books starts in this one. And he refines his perceptions over time, embroiders them, and explains them more fully. And it provides a really interesting worldview.
Nice.
And it's also a really great story. I mean, like, it's a really great potboiler. Like you said, it's a caper where the object of the caper is engineering the caper itself. It's also got hints of noir. So it's, you know, if you like a story where there are no overtly good guys, but there are people you can root for or against, this is a good one.
Cool. Well, you have convinced me that I need to go back and give it another look.
Good.
Because while I wasn't thrilled with it, I did admire it. And so, and it's one that I bought when it was cheap. A while back, so I will definitely do that.
Okay, let me know how you think the second time.
Yeah, sounds good.
Well, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for doing this. I when I originally came up with the idea of doing this podcast, it was after I had started doing the editing for the Supergirl Supercast, I was so glad that I had done that, so that I at least had some contacts of other podcasters.
Yeah,
and I thought if I can get Lisa on this show, then I'll be legit. So.
You are flattering me. I love it.
So here it is.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you. It was wonderful to have an excuse to read this again and talk about it with somebody, especially since the conversation was like, I loved it. Yeah, me too.
Right.
Those are the best conversations when it isn't just people agreeing, you know?
Yeah. So, but I want to thank you for your time and flexibility. I know you're busy with family and work and lots of other podcasting. So it was great to get a chance to talk to you.
You too. I look forward to catching up on some of the back ones. And I can't wait to hear when you talk to Mandy and see what she has to say too. I podcasted with her a little bit on the Supergirl podcast as well. And Mandy is sharp. I look forward to that. Awesome.
Yeah. Well, I had Michael Gabriel, who's her podcast co-host.
Yeah.
To talk about Dune for episode number two. So
I was going to say The Incomparables actually spun off a lot of really great connections. So, you know, it's funny how it turns into 6 degrees of, I worked with so-and-so and so-and-so. And
right.
It's all for the good, you know?
Yep. Yeah. Well, thanks for doing this. Bye.
My pleasure. Bye.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Lisa, and I encourage you to find her online and definitely check out The Incomparable if you haven't already. I'll make sure to put links in the show notes for everything relevant there. As mentioned on this podcast, for my July episode, I will be talking with Mandy Self about Orson Scott Card's Speaker for the Dead, and I'm very much looking forward to that. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch, you can do that through email. It's feedback@hugospodcast.com. You can find us on social media as well. We're at Hugo's Podcast on Twitter, facebook.com/Hugo's Podcast, and check out our website, hugospodcast.com. And of course, if you care to leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or any other platform, I'd really appreciate it. And that'll about do it for this time. So I will talk to you next time. Bye.
It's Tom Clancy, except with lasers.
Yeah, lasers and rivets on the cover.
Oh, God, always.
That's how you know it's a science fiction book, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If it has trees, it's fantasy.
That's a really good rule. It's also the difference between a flowing gown versus a cleavage-bearing spacesuit.
Correct. Yeah.
Because, you know, there's the cleavage-bearing flowing gown where it's a wizardess and clearly her power lays in her décolletage. Or it's a cleavage-bearing spacesuit where, like, the hex wrench she needs has been stored in her bra. So, you know, either way, there's always a good explanation for why you've got the cleavage on the cover.
Nice.
This is Cleavage in Sci-Fi with Seth and Lisa. Right.